Hello and welcome to Tape Notes, the podcast that looks behind the scenes at the magic of recording and producing music. Every episode, we'll be reuniting an artist and producer and talking through some of the highlights from their collaboration in the studio. So join us as we lift the lid on the creative process and the inner workings of music production to see what lies beneath. Hello, my name is John Kennedy. Welcome to this special episode where we'll be bringing you some of the highlights of the many inspiring conversations we've had over the past season on Tape Notes with the brilliant artists and producers that we've been lucky enough to talk to about the alchemy of creating music together. If you're relatively new to the show, it's a great opportunity to introduce yourself to episodes and artists you haven't heard yet, and for the dedicated among you, a gentle trip down memory lane with some of our favourite moments so far. In this episode, you'll hear from Friendly Fires and Mark Ralph, These New Puritans, Elbow, Ezra Collective, Mystery Jets and Matt Twaits, DJ Shadow, and we'll start at the beginning of the season with Muramasa. For our first episode of Season 4, we were at home in Iguana Studios, joined by the talented and insightful Alex Crossan, better known as Muramasa, to talk about his latest album, RYC. We hear the building blocks of Feels Like We're Dancing, advice on when to stop working on a track, a demo of Teenage Headache Dreams, which went on to feature Ellie of Wolf Alice, and a word about working with other stars. But to start, a clip from his freestyle studio session with the inimitable Slow Tie on the track that turned into Deal With It.
Wake up feeling complacent. I step outside and see the rain falling on my fucking toe cap. I was steel as the shoes were, but kicking in front doors. Waiting for an applause of the local knobhead. Nobby's nuts don't crack enough for me, son. I was waiting patiently in vain like my name's Bob. Bob, you soggy SpongeBob twat, soaking up everything you've never had. It's mad how life.
So he's just coming up with that off the top of his head, or had he written anything down? Or?
No, the whole thing is improvised.
That's so good.
And like the fact that we had like 20 minutes and we managed to hone it down into this tight 3-minute thing. And also the whole idea of like Deal With It, I think he mentions it once in this whole sort of 20 minutes. There's a lot of interesting things about this song because it's kind of built around this guitar riff, which is just 3 notes essentially. You can hear the bleed from the pickup, which again is like a tactile in the room thing. So yeah, all the guitars on the album are just straight DI'd, apart from the acoustic. And then obviously the Rhodes. And I tried to play all the keys parts on a MIDI keyboard to give them a bit more of a human feel. And then the Freddie Mercury reverse piano. Another one bites the dust.
So when do you know it's finished?
That's a really good question. When do you know it's finished? It really depends on the song, but for me a big indicator is, do I get bored at some point listening to it? And if so, why? Is it that specific part? Is it the amount of time that it takes to get to that part? Like on some of those earlier demos, you can hear at the start that I've got this kind of mood setting. There's kind of a bit of world building before the song comes in. But then at the same time, on the finished record, it just jumps straight in, and that's a lot more immediate. And for me, a song is done when you've made all those really difficult calls. So that can take forever, but I feel like, yeah, if you're not bored at any point during a song, it's probably done.
Yeah, that's a good test.
Maybe. No. If you're making pop music, it's very different for different types of music.
I want to be free.
Again, not a very good vocal.
Remember how we used to be.
Don't know, sounds good to me.
It's all right.
Sit at home and dream. Stare at each other like TV.
So there's no harmonium on this, but it was written on the harmonium.
Yeah, there ended up being some, which I'll show you later in the project.
Come back to me at night.
I just like that that fifth guitar line, it kind of reminds me of Joy Division and Sonic Youth and things like that.
I don't know how, I just feel down. Teenage headache dreams.
That was me being Ellie.
Seems like the good times are.
What would become Ellie?
Yeah.
Nothing's really over anymore.
So you can kind of hear that essentially the whole song is already there, but then I just got lost here, and there's two more minutes of music and no vocals, and it kind of goes into this, what you might recognise as Ellie's verse, essentially. Mm. I've had the pleasure of working with some of the maddest musicians, like Nile Rodgers. He does a really interesting thing, which is he always starts the song with the hook, which I just thought was fascinating. Like, just get to it, get to the meat. Damon Albarn as well taught me something that isn't exactly to do with music, but he had invited me to his studio to talk about Gorillaz and kind of me working on the Gorillaz project, and that sort of started a conversation about him featuring on my album. And I was peppering him with questions about the Gorillaz album, like, what's it about? What are you looking for? What exactly do you want me to do? And as I was sort of hitting him with all these questions, he sort of leaned over and he put his hand on my leg and he went, we are going to see each other again. Like, don't worry. And that was just really like, oh yeah, this isn't some like summit. We are going to communicate again. And like, I think that just taught me to treat everybody just as people, you know.
I love that. I love the fact that Alex Crossan, such a young artist, Muramasa, starting out, getting that kind of reassurance from the likes of Damon Albarn and realising, hang on a minute, I'm in this for the long haul, I'm here to stay. And he certainly is. What an amazing artist. And if you haven't heard the full episode, do go back and listen to the whole thing. Next up, we have Ed and Jack from Friendly Fires and producer Mark Ralph, recorded on two separate occasions. First, Iguana Studios, then Mark's own studio, Club Ralph, in West London, where he and the band worked together. We start with the demo of Love Like Waves, then talk drum recording, followed by Jack's 909 live take that formed the backbeat to Can't Wait Forever. And finally, a word on references in the studio.
So this is the first demo recorded your parents' house.
The first, the first like vocal jams, I guess.
Strap in because it's about 7 minutes long.
Yeah.
And what are you playing here then? No, what instruments?
It's the Arp Oddity doing the lead line, and then it's like a really cheesy Rompler piano sound. I mean, we used Omnisphere, which is like a VST fake synth, basically, but it was kind of emulating the JD800 that Mark actually bought after he finished the record.
Yeah, so, sometimes you try these old synths out by proxy, you kind of find the new recreation of them and get so into them that you want to actually have the real thing.
Yeah.
So I went straight onto eBay after we'd done one of the songs. I don't know if it was this song or
it's the whole record.
Another,
I think it was
maybe
the
whole record, but I just had to have one, having used the soft synth version of it.
Yeah.
So. It's quite hard to completely separate. It's impossible to completely separate drum mics when you're recording a drum kit. But what I really like doing, and what we've got really good at over the course of this record, was actually, having learnt the drum part and having got some live recordings, actually going through and doing a full take of the song, but on every single separate live drum instrument. So you sit there with a kick drum and you'd remember exactly what came where, because we'd just done 10 takes of the full thing live. But you have to like imagine your hands playing everything else. The only thing that's being recorded is your kick drum foot. So here's live kick. There we go.
Wicked.
Banging.
So
So all those little hits you're playing.
Yeah, and I think Mark sort of cut them out and...
Yeah, we did a bit of editing afterwards, but often, you know, you can kind of...
Well, if you hear... Listen here, you can hear the snare slowly opening up.
Yeah.
All those kind of subtleties, you know, they make a difference.
Yeah.
I think we tried to record as much from the four outputs.
Okay, tried to do it live and then did some overdubs of...
Yeah.
I think if you only reference one artist and one piece of music for the track that you're doing, then your song will probably sound like a pale imitation of the one thing that you're taking inspiration from. But if you've got several sources, then it becomes a melting pot of all the different ideas that you've got, and that way becomes something original and something unique, you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
I think even I'm jumping ahead to the vocals again. Yeah. But
you're obsessed.
I'm obsessed with my voice. the delay settings, I remember we were the kind of echo delay settings. We were like, oh, this has got a kind of Rick Astley, Never Gonna Give You Up. And then we were listening to that track and we were just, when you actually listen to how the delay is ridden on that track, it's on the fly, isn't it?
So it's on the fly, yeah. There's if you really break that track down and you listen to it in a way that normal people and I never listened to it before ever, and you kind of just start to analyze what's going on in the mix of it, you realize there's some quite clever little things that you would never realize before. And I think we probably watched the same Top of the Pops 2 the night before or something and heard it, and there's some little delay rides which really accentuate certain notes that you just take for granted. No, you know, it's such a well-known song. But when you actually sit there and analyse it, you go, wow, there's something quite clever that's just going on there that makes that lyric pop out to you. And we just came up with the idea of throwing a bit of that in. I mean, again, nobody's going to listen to any of the Friendly Fire songs. It's such a Rick Astley, Rick Astley vibe on that.
Fascinating to hear the detail that these people listen to things. Amazing. Who would know that Rick Astley had an influence on the work of Friendly Fires? So that was Ed and Jack from Friendly Fires with producer Mark Ralph. And now we're going to continue again in Iguana Studio for episode 36, joined this time by brothers George and Jack Barnett of These New Puritans to talk about their latest album, Inside the Rose. George starts us off with a dream.
So this song started as a dream. I went through a period of dreaming music. Yeah, I sort of trained myself to wake up in the night and record the musical ideas. In the dream, I was walking along with an old friend of mine, Rory, and we were walking along the marshes in Southend, in Leontea, in fact. And we saw over the other side of the river burning. We could see that the trees, something was on fire. And then Rory said to me, look over there, there's trees are on fire. And then in the dream, the music just started up like it was a musical. And so this is what I sang. And all of those lyrics are in the song.
Yeah.
Maybe unchanged, the melody.
So all the melody and the lyric came from the dream.
Yeah, well, I've lost the knack of it now. Now I don't wake up. I sometimes
Second
even
sleep.
Dream that I've woken up and recorded it. It's almost like my brain is tricking me. No, you need to sleep. You shouldn't be working on music now.
Like interjecting.
So there's contrast.
Yeah.
Between.
So the title of the demo is pretty accurate, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is another one that I had on my phone, and I was just driving around in a Aphex Twin window licker style car, like a white Mercedes, driving around LA really fast with the volume like cranked up to complete maximum, trying to scare people witless with the roof down, you know, when the subs come in.
Tried things like that.
What are those metal bits?
There's a few things. There's metal rods. Tick, tick, tick. And so there's also on the snare is like an aluminium sheet.
Right.
And we made all that stuff, you know, metal cutters and nice sort of metal drumsticks, which I'm still playing with live. They're like a rod of steel with my own sort of handles.
Right, wow.
Gaffer taped handles, basically. Yeah.
And in terms of your musical educations...
Zero
completely for both of you.
Yeah, I mean, I learned the guitar.
I think there's a fetishization of studio gear. Maybe this is the wrong podcast to say this in, but where it's like, okay, this could be the big difference between something sounding good and bad. But ultimately, the main thing is the performance, the room it's in to some extent. But even with a close mic'd vocal, that's not going to make that much difference. And then way, way back behind that is like microphone. And then beyond that, like far in the distance, is like compressors and all this kind of stuff, which are just, to me, is not going to make or break the sound of it.
Mm. But they are still relevant in the sense that you love your Fender Rhodes. You know, you want to use 100%. That.
But I guess you've also got to, if you're making an album, you've got to kind of prioritize one thing over another. If you're thinking about everything all the time, then you're not going to end up with, you know, it's going to be a mess.
Yeah.
And so that string part is taken from one of those very first demos that we put together, just that harmony going against the other harmonies.
And that's a standard bass guitar, well, a standard, but a particular...
Yeah.
What bass guitar do you favour, or do you have a few?
The bass we've used and have always used is one that our older brother found in a local paper in Basildon for 20 quid, and it was covered in wall paint, black wall paint. And he chipped it away, and underneath it was this beautiful Epiphone bass from the 70s. So we've always used that ever since.
It's a very distinctive sound it has as well.
So there's these parts, then piano, guitars.
Drums.
Microphones.
You may have heard us talk about Tape It before, and if you haven't, then let me fill you in, as they are the sponsor of today's episode with a fantastic offer for you. Tape It is an iPhone recording app made by musicians for musicians. Many of our guests on Tape Notes, music industry friends and listeners, rely on voice notes to record their early ideas. People like the Lumineers, Ezra Collective and Fred Again have all shared recordings with us made on voice notes. But what you wouldn't have heard are the long pauses where they're searching for those recordings. We wouldn't want to put you through that. As you can understand, organising and finding the right notes, let alone a specific part, can be a nightmare. Tape It solves all of that voice memo chaos with intuitive labelling features, including automatic instrument detection, markers and collaborative mixtapes, meaning you can share band practices, organise set lists and brainstorm ideas with co-writers and band members. Plus, you can record straight from your lock screen and attach text and photo notes to each recording. One of our favourite features within Tape It Pro is that you can record in stereo using two microphones along with gentler dynamic compression to give a much more natural sound than any of the usual apps. It's a huge upgrade to the microphone and all-round audio quality. It really helps support the podcast whenever you engage with our sponsors. So if Tape It sounds like an app you'd use, then do us a favour. Pause the episode, head to the link in a recent episode show notes, or visit tape.it/tape notes and give Tape It a go. That's tape.it/tape notes. You can download for free or use the promo code Tape Notes for 50% off Tape It Pro. Thank you, and now on with the show. Did you do it? Honestly, Tape It is fantastic. All of the Tape Notes team members are complete converts, and excitingly, some of our guests have started to use it as well. So I really would recommend checking it out. Absolutely beautiful, and I can't recommend the album enough. Inside the Rose, it really is an incredible journey to go on, and the episode that we had with them was fascinating. Next up, Elbow frontman Guy Garvey, who popped down the road from his Brixton studio to join us at Iguana, whilst fellow band member and producer of the record, Craig Potter, dialed in from his studio in Manchester to share stories from the making of Giants of All Sizes. There's wisdom from Guy, beautiful early demo lyrics to Onderonder Road that never made the cut, but we start with Guy on guitar.
What makes it sound backwards on those parts when it stabs is I've got an octave on it. So I'm only playing the high note. The low tone you can hear is being processed, and because it does it slightly late, it gives it the backwards effect. And then there's two delays, one in each ear.
It sounds great. I mean, it's interesting because you've kind of played up the idea that you are inept and can't play. But when I listen to that on its own, I think that's sounds like somebody who knows what they're doing.
Thanks, John.
And if I were watching that, at a gig, I'd be thinking, ah, oh, he's really good, that bloke. He really knows what he's doing.
I remember one song, which around the time we were making Leaders of the Free World, I think that was the first time that Craig was taking the helm as producer. And we worked on this song endlessly. We were working day and night at that point. And we finished it and we were celebrating and we played it really loud. And then we put a couple of the tunes that we already had for the record on and listened to it again. And we got about four bars in before we all went, turn it off. And we've never heard it since. It was so bad. But we'd worked so hard on it.
Yeah.
But we all hated it instantly.
It's easy to convince yourself in the buzz of the moment, isn't it?
It's like you'd be very carefully respraying T-cut in your car, polishing it to a high shine, you step back and it's lime green. Was that a terrible analogy?
I don't know. Some people might like lime green. You know, that's the thing. They might think, yes, I am the business.
I know right now you need a diaper that a man has dismissed. We'll slowly roll out in a tube on a lake of mirrored grace. The strains tribute your deity and ping pong paddle pound. Season sets a giant net that's an ancient, patient thing.
So it went on like that.
Yeah.
It goes on like that. And I really nailed the imagery. I was really happy how well I explained it. But ultimately, it said, I've been to India. So I fucked it off.
Right. So not only is East Lancs Railway ditched, but Udaipur is ditched as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who wants to hear about my holiday? Nobody.
It is a shame because you do paint that picture really well.
There was more guitars added to that, like a little pig nose thing, which is a guitar with a speaker in it. Little fuzzy fly sounding.
Does that make it?
Yep, that's in there.
Those big nose guitars, I made a habit of giving those out to friends, didn't I, on the road before I realised how much they cost. Chris Martin got one, Jim from Granddaddy got one, and somebody said, we stop giving them away, like 200 quid. I was like, what? I thought they were like 20 quid. We've used them a lot though, haven't we?
Yeah, a lot. So this is just a loop round.
You know, if you're not enjoying this, there's something seriously wrong. This is rock and roll. This is not chartered accountancy. You're supposed to be carrying a torch, and it's about freedom and fun and expression. And, you know, of course it's magic, and of course the end result should reflect a lot of work, but that work is made of bits of toast and string and something you saw through a bus window. You can't over dramatize the writing process. You've just got to start. There's no such thing as writer's block. It's a complete, you know, if you believe in it, then yes, you can make it exist. But it's like, if you sit down and you write something terrible, if you didn't write it then, it'd still be waiting in the pipe the next time you sat down. So even your shit work is really positive forward motion, you know. Think of it as plumbing. There's my advice.
And talking of plumbing... Such words of wisdom from the one and only Guy Garvey. Next up, a very inspiring episode with the London jazz force that are Ezra Collective. We were joined by TJ, Femi and James to talk about their incredible debut album, You Can't Steal My Joy. There's a clear message that you don't need any expensive gear to put down the basis of a great tune, and TJ starts us off with the story behind the song that led to the concept behind the album.
The album concept was You Can't Steal My Joy. I was really exploring the concept of what joy looks like. And I was thinking back to the times I was happiest. A particular moment that stands out for me as one of my most joyful experiences was watching BBK at Bestival. And I just remember seeing a few of the BBK members behind at the back. I saw light flashed and I saw, oh, that's Skep there. Light flashed again, I saw that's Jay and me, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, it's about to kick off. And Skep just jumped out from the back and started shouting, I'm doing it again, they tried to stop me, but I'm doing it again. And they wheeled it up and he looked so vexed as he was rapping, but he came out, it wasn't even their set yet, the vibes were too correct and it erupted and everyone starts going mad. See where this is going now. And then when they come back out, I think Jay and me ran out first. He started rapping. I can't remember what verse he started rapping. And then Skepta comes out.
Serious.
Yeah. He come out and started rapping for Serious. Then Skepta comes out again. And before you know it, a mosh pit had erupted. But everyone was on the same energy. And they started rapping their old school bars. Everyone's rapping. Like my boy, remember, told me he dislocated his shoulder. Like it wasn't a good moment. But he dislocated his shoulder. Some girl popped it back in for him. He continued the shoves. Yeah, it was
mental.
It was after that when I was like, that was one of the most joyful moments of my whole life. But from the outside, looking in, like if my mom saw that, she would have been thinking, what is wrong with these people? Why are they all so mad? Why are they all fighting? So when it comes to why are you mad, I wrote that song very much from a kind of, from the outside, it can look mad and manic and mental and whatever, but really and truly, you don't know what joy looks like until you know the inside of someone and what the heart behind it is.
So what I have here is me getting a song in my head, but then I try and beatbox, sing and hum everyone's parts. So I can remember what I want everyone to do. I need to give this context because it sounds awful. It's out of tune. I'm half panting because I'm walking fast. Yeah. So what you're going to hear is me singing the drum beat so I can hear it. And then I sing a bit of the bass line and then I go back into the horn line, sing the melody. And I'm trying to put the arrangement and the composition all in one. Now, what's special about having a band of people that you've grown up with and love is they understand these voice notes now. But yeah, I just had to defend it, so it doesn't sound pretty at all.
Wow. I mean, how long is that?
For ages, I thought I needed, like, you know, drum machines and you needed, like, this and that and that and that. It's such a myth, isn't it? You know, like, you just need to get on with it and sort of sit down and you use what you have. And I got GarageBand, so I was just, like, you know, on the bus, just sort of messing about.
So, I mean, what can we hear then? What are you going to share with us, James?
So, what do you want to hear, like, the melody that I wrote before I did it on the saxophone?
Yeah.
Okay. Even playing this. I'm just like, all I've got is little
drag. Honestly, thank you for today, because just going back through my voice memos, I found 5 tunes that I'd forgotten about.
I can't like, even lie. Even then, I started tunes, to have. When I heard You Can't Steal My Joy, I just started getting way more confidence in those other voice memos I have, because I listen back to them and I'm like, this just sounds like trash. And then I listen to the You Can't Steal My Joy one. Like, this sounds like trash, but became a song. So this has been good for
us. There's a couple albums here. Thank you, man.
Ezra Collective.
But it's one of the great things about doing tech notes is that when we've heard
Nathaniel Facey, who was one of the tutors that I had at Tomorrow's Warriors, he was the person that put the thought into my head that records are just a documentation of time. And that really, really, really helped me, because it took the pressure away from... I started to look at albums more like a diary entry as opposed to a seminal piece of work that presents itself as a novel, which can add so much pressure. And that I would give that advice to anyone, and I'll give it away to everyone. Love and learn to appreciate and enjoy where you are at this very moment, because it's something to document. If you're sad, document that. If you're happy, document that. But just when you document things, be honest about the process. If you're broke, make a broke album. If you've got loads of money, I want to hear it sounding mixed and mastered well.
Incredible insight from Femi of Ezra Collective, and we can't overstate the importance of Tomorrow's Warriors on the British jazz scene. For our next highlight, we travel to the Brainyard in East London to join lead singer and writer of Mystery Jets, Blaine Harrison, and producer Matt Thwaites in their bunker studio. We hear about the lengths they'll go to create a more inspiring click track for drummer Caps, how to use your baby's heartbeat as a sample, and finally ending the album with a quack. But first, Blaine tells us about finding Narnia.
In the past, particularly making Curve, I'd always found that I needed to get as far away as possible from London commitments and London life. So isolating myself had always proven to be really effective to just get on with writing, and I'd come back with a bunch of songs. So for this record, I thought I'd done a beach hut by the sea. I'd spent some time on a boat moored on a really remote part of the Thames. I thought, how can I get even further? So I thought, why don't I go to Iceland?
Didn't you also have a spa with Bjork?
That is a true story. That did happen. So it was New Year's Day. It's kind of customary tradition that everyone goes to these hot springs. So we went to one of the smaller ones in Reykjavik, but it was pitch dark and it started raining. I think I was just feeling a little bit lost in that moment. And I turned to my right and there was Bjork just lying in the bubbles next to me, just having a really lovely time. And I didn't disturb her. I didn't say anything, but it felt a bit like going to like Narnia and meeting Aslan, if you know what I mean.
I think it is literally that.
Yeah. I would imagine that as a drummer, it can get so tedious just hearing beep, bop, bop, bop. Beep.
Oh, yeah. So it was to replace the click.
So it was a click. It was right. Essentially it was a kind of really demonic click
and
track.
Because it's, you know, parts of it are aggressive. We wanted to sort of create that environment, but we didn't leave it in the track because...
Right, okay. But we can hear the marching that helped inspire Caps.
He would have to tell you whether it inspired him.
So you were kind of chanting as well.
We're chanting and...
If there is feet stomping, they're really small feet.
They're really tiny little centipede feet.
Wow, this is amazing. So you did all this.
Yeah.
Then he drummed along to that.
Exactly, yeah.
And then you took that original caveman marching thing out of it completely.
Sounds like an out of breath dog, doesn't it? I remember it being a lot scarier than that.
So let's hear what Caps came up with then to the sound of that.
He came to the studio one day and he had a recording from the heart rate monitor taken through the belly. And I think we kind of joked that we'd have a competition to see who could be the first person to use it in a track.
Yeah. Right.
It's the classic musician who has a kid, like all their noises turn up. I've got like three tracks with hiccups in somewhere on my hard drive and like gurgles, like, oh yeah, make a track out of it. But yeah, we did actually put it in this track.
But we recorded it in, and I think it just, obviously given the title of the song, it just felt so appropriate to have.
So Aubrey's heartbeat from the womb.
In utero, yeah.
Sure, there'll be some mothers listening that recognise that sound.
Yeah, that's really interesting hearing that. Also completely out of context, because normally if you are privileged enough to hear that, you're in a hospital and you've got a certain level of expectation and...
Terror.
Terror.
We added in a Moog arpeggiator underneath it, as you do.
We've got to hear that now.
The quack.
Yeah, definitely.
So yeah, I'll just quickly show you what it is. I think it's just the end of the chorus, I think. Just to...
Bang!
That.
So it's the last word of the chorus.
Yeah.
There's a low one and then an octave up as well. And then put a load of delay, delay and verb. Well, it's just there, just tucked in.
And it's the last sound you hear.
And it is the last sound you hear on the record.
So it's on the record, so it's the final reveal.
The final reveal. I love that phrase. I love the fact that they think about the drama of the records that they're making. Matt and Blaine talking about A Billion Heartbeats by Mystery Jets. And for our final episode of this season of Tape Notes, we had Josh Davis, better known as the legendary DJ Shadow, who he caught up with at Wendy House Studios in West London whilst he was over on his recent UK tour. You'll hear about the exceptional attention to detail that goes into working on the samples he uses, and so much more. Not least, that even the mighty make mistakes.
There was something about the guitar, the kind of dun 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 dun, just this note playing over and over, and shall I play it?
Yeah.
Anytime I work with samples, and especially if I'm basing a track off a sample, as I have in this case, to me, I always want other producers to listen to the original and go, wow, how did he do that out of that? The top of the descending riff is bare, but a lot of the other pieces had to be pieced together and filtered, and it can often take 2 or 3 days to really get a sample to do and be what you want it to be. I had to retune it slightly because on the record, it's actually, there's kind of a lateral in and out, not a warp, but just the way it was pressed made the fidelity kind of rise and fall. And if I hadn't have gone in and taken each little bling, 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 and tune it slightly, it makes you a bit seasick, you know what I mean?
You've got all those different elements in that guitar break. How did you weld them together so seamlessly?
Let's see. I mean, I actually use Pro Tools to clean samples, because I just like how granular you can get, and I can go in and notch. And it's almost like animation. It can take like half an hour to do a second of audio, because that's the demand I have on the sample to be as clear as I want it to be. And then my arrangement, my merging of all the different elements happens in Ableton Live now. To me, I felt a bit lost after the MPC era. I put the MPC away around 2002. And for about 8 years, I felt a bit adrift production-wise. I went from this to that. Still doesn't feel natural. And then I got on Ableton Live, and I felt like it's the perfect combination of endless possibilities and convenient and helpful parameters. And it speaks to my mind. It speaks to the way my brain works. My dad had reached out and said a friend of his has some records. He's like approaching 70 and he just wants to unload them. And I was kind of calculating in my mind, and I went, okay, that's a 2-hour drive there, a 2-hour drive back. Why am I doing this? I already have X amount of records. I don't need to do this. I got there, picked up the records. It was basically kind of what I thought it would be. It was just a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And so I dutifully was going through everything, and I picked up the record and I just sort of stared at it a while, and it dawned on me that I would never have brought this record in my house, ever. I have very diverse musical taste. There's almost nothing I would censor or just say no. But revivalist a cappella doo-wop from the 70s was just not something. I mean, that didn't interest me. I was just staring at it, and I put the record on and just let it play. And I heard this sample, and it just spoke to me instantly in the same way that the sample from Nobody Speak did, where I just kind of went, A, I don't think anybody would ever use this, and B, I think I can really do something with it. So here's the vocal sample again. I think this is about halfway in the middle of the song. Bring the drums in. And I don't remember at one point I added the bass line, but that comes in. And it's kind of a deep sub. Let's get the horns going in here. There were some background vocals that De La added. Ready, set. Stay back. Then jump to the rhythm as hard as you can go. And then of course the scratching. funny and or tragic note about the scratch solo there. I somehow managed to release the record without realizing that that scratch solo was mixed out of phase. And I didn't realize it until it was played on Six Music on the BBC. We have our Sonos system set up to wake up to Six Music in the morning. But our speaker is just, it's one stereo summed speaker. So if something's out of phase, that sound will disappear. And the scratch solo kept coming in and I'd kind of sit there in the kitchen going, what's happening? What's wrong? And I kicked it over to Count, my engineer, and he goes, oh, how did that happen? I was like, I don't know, but it's bad. We need to fix it. So we ended up swapping it out on the DSPs a couple of months after it was out because I was like, I can't have that floating around the internet forever.
Yeah.
If you own vinyl and CD, yeah, it's probably out of phase, but it just goes to show you, it doesn't matter what a big shot you think you are, you're going to make very major errors if you didn't go to engineering school.
Stay alert. It's the key lesson there from DJ Shadow. Everyone can make a mistake. Thank you very much for listening to this best of episode of Tape Notes. We hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget, if you want to find out anything more about us and what we're up to, just head over to our socials or the website tapenotes.co.uk for all the latest info and pictures behind the scenes. We'll leave you with one last thought from DJ Shadow about the importance of knowing when you need to go the extra mile.
And I don't apply this same level of obsessiveness to every song, but I think when songs have a possibility to be something more than what my own fans expect, or, you know, in this case, what Run the Jewels' fans expect, then I think I have an obligation to the song and to the sweat equity that we all put into it. I want it to reach as many people as possible.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. We should hear the master, maybe at the point where we have a bit of vocal and then go into the horns and then...
Yeah, let's just play it from here.
Start popping your bunions, I'm coming, I'm the dumbest. Who flame throw your fuck shit to bunions? Flame your crew quicker than Trump fucks his youngest. Now face the flame fuckers, your fame and fate's done with. I walk Charlie Brown, Peppermint, Patty, Linus, and Lucy. Put coke in the doobie, roll woolies to smoke with Snoopy. I still remain that dick rabbit slacker to spill the wookie. Cause the total of the toolie will murder you friggin' moolies. Fuck outta here.